Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories from great Americans who are making a difference. Your host is West Point grad, former Army Ranger, and founder of Authentically American, Dean Wegner.
Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast. We've got a special episode for you today, recorded on location at Bridgestone Arena in downtown Nashville with another great American, my friend Sean Henry, the CEO of the Nashville Predators. Sean has been instrumental in building one of the greatest franchises in all of sports and one of the most amazing live experiences in all of entertainment. As a huge hockey fan, sitting down with Sean was a big thrill for me personally. Sean has been through and lived so many great stories on his path to success, and I know you're going to absolutely love his perspective on a wide range of topics. You may hear some construction sounds periodically throughout the interview. That's the sound of Nashville glowing literally as we speak. We do apologize, but hopefully you'll be so engaged in today's conversation, you won't even notice. Well, Sean, thank you. It's an honor to be here at Bridgestone and having you as a guest on our Authentically American Podcast. Appreciate you investing the time.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for asking me.
Well, part of me struggles with where to begin because your career and everything you've accomplished, but I'm just a big believer that so much happens early in your childhood and upbringing. And, you know, what did I read? You had one of six kids growing up?
One of six. I was the most wanted one. I was the youngest. You know, they're all about a year apart. And I fortunately came along about 5 years later. So they all had hand-me-downs and I had brand new equipment and clothes. They must have loved me more.
So what was it like, you know, family-wise growing up?
I was a pretty fortunate guy. Four sisters, a brother, all took care of me. A pretty spoiled kid. I really was. My dad was a carpenter. My mom stayed at home. And I was just, you know, something out of a sitcom. You know, whether it would be Sandlot or a mixture of that or Stand By Me. It was just a great place to grow up. Long Island time I did. Everyone had big families. You know, you went out in the morning, you came home when it was dark. My time I'd be home was dusk. And that was always interpretive, and that's where I learned to negotiate. Because when I get home, my parents would be mad at me. I said, you can still see the glimmer of
just that light. Just yeah. Right there at the
so
top.
So they started buying me watches, and I used to break watches quite a bit, because I was so active. So then we finally just agreed on when it was dark, I had to be home. But it was a wonderful place to grow up. Okay. Again, you know, my parents were wonderful. People always ask, what about my dad, what about mom, what were they like? Yeah. So I don't know, you can't tell them apart. They're always together, they were one. We always ate together, which I don't know why that's so special today. Oh, yeah. You know, for so many people, we're just what you did. You know, whether you got home from practice or work, you know, we all had part-time jobs. There was always dinner, and you always ate with somebody. You woke up in the morning, you played
part
games
with
someone. Yeah. Yeah, it was just wonderful. But the whole neighborhood was like that. And you know, today, there's a lot of elements of that, which is good. But I think the best thing for me was you were always encouraged to do things. And
right.
At the time, I hated it. You know, my parents would say you have to be part of X number of activities, mm-hmm. whether that be sports or music or drama or X clubs. It wasn't an option. You were going to be diversified, you're going to do a lot of things. And, you know, looking back on it, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Absolutely. So you're in the sports and entertainment business now. So is that a big part of your upbringing, what you were involved? You mentioned all those activities. What you really spent your time as a kid?
Like most kids of that time, you played everything, regardless of how good or bad you were at it. It's just what you did in the neighborhood. But you followed the seasons, you know, and the sun decided what you did. You know, whether you played lacrosse or baseball or football or soccer or basketball, it was based weather dependent. You always played a lot of different things in little leagues, and as you got older and older, you started funneling down to one or two or three sports. But that was always it for me. I just assumed I'd play for the Yankees. I'm still waiting. You know, they haven't called yet. I thought when Jeter retired, this was it. They were going to, you know, ring me up, and they didn't, despite many a coach explaining to me why that would never happen. I had a lot of coaches in lacrosse tell me I should play baseball, and a lot of baseball coaches tell me I should play soccer. You'll get that if you think about it long enough. For me, sports was just center of so much of what we did as a family. We didn't go to many games growing up. We always went to at least one Yankee game a year, one Met game a year, because they were always cheaper. Mm-hmm. Not that you wanted to go, but you did. Never went to an NFL football game, never went to a college football game until I was in college. Money was not that it was tight, but it just wasn't there for things like that. We used to go to a lot of Long Island Ducks games, you know, minor league hockey team. Yeah. But it was everything. We're always together. So everything was a big deal. You know, we celebrated. But there were a few things they always did. You know, on Labor Day, you always went to Jones Beach Theater to see a Broadway play before it got converted to an amphitheater. Got to see Joe Namath do Damn Yankees. And at the time, thinking, oh my gosh, I have to go see a play. This is awful. But, you know, your parents were, you know, pushing you to things. And you went to Radio City every year, went to museums. So it was never part of what we thought we would do for a living. It's what you did for fun and to be together. So I mean, I got into this really by accident. I've never not been doing this for a living. When I started, I was 14 years old. I was a busboy at Jones Beach State Park, Robert Moses State Park. The company I worked for, I didn't know at the time. It was just a part-time job, great place to work. You know, they serve sports teams around the country. And when I first started, I was 14 years old. My job was, I was a busboy at the beach. You know what that entails?
Oh, yeah.
You sweep sand off the patio. The great thing about sweeping sand off the patio at the beach is, you know what happens when you're done? You start over again. It's a never-ending. And if you ever got ahead of it, you had a chance to scrub, you know, seagull droppings off the picnic table. And you know what happens when you're done with that? You start over again. Yeah, because they just keep dropping and the wind keeps blowing. But it was just a great place to work. Again, it's something that, you know, you look back on it, and I was just a pretty lucky kid to be able to work there. You go there at 7 in the morning, boogie board, swim, whatever. You start working at 11, or you got there at 7, you stop working at 3, and you swam. So.
It's interesting to hear the background about things like Radio City Music Hall. Because I didn't know that part about you, but I mentioned that you're in the sports and entertainment business, and that's what, I mean, you and the whole team have done such an amazing job that it's not only a sports venue, but entertainment and experience. So it's interesting to hear that part of your background.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just what you did, right? Uh-huh. You just did things. But it's funny, when we say sports and entertainment, the only question that confuses me about my career, people always say, well, do you work for the Preds or Bridgestone Arena? Do you work for the Lightning or St. Pete Times Forum? Do you like work for the Pistons or Palace Auburn Hills? And I always look at people with a really blank expression on it because I don't know how to answer it. You know, it's like, you know, do you work for GM or Chevy? Yeah. Yes.
Both.
You know, both. And some people, for whatever reason, just can't wrap their arms around that. When you look at the most successful sports teams in the country, throughout time, they've always controlled the venue. And the ones that were really successful made the venue as busy as possible, and it really connected the dots. And, you know, when Tom Seagram became chairman here, one of the first things he identified was, hey, this is what we are as a team. You know, we've never gotten out of the first round. We're not looking 10, 20 years down the road with our roster. We've never supported the best GM in sports and David Poyle with the resources to look that far down the road. And part of it was because we weren't driving the resources to do that. And then he started looking at other organizations of, you know, who did a good job of planning rosters, filling the building. And normally they were in venues that were fairly busy for non-hockey games, non-basketball games. And so when we started talking, he wanted to talk more about what we were doing with our building in Tampa and why. Well, the why is pretty simple. I mean, the more you generate, the more you have to put into the overall machine. But when you connect everything and you make, you know, hockey operations just one department within the overall organization, something pretty special happens. And that's what we're living right now.
Absolutely. Well, one other thing you had mentioned, you know, the Yankees. So you're still waiting for that call to come to the big leagues, but...
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't like how you're laughing about that. You know, well, by the grace of God, I was born a Yankee fan. And I assume I'll play for him someday, but it's, well, days are getting dark fast.
I'm laughing because I'm waiting for David Poyle to call me and come watch me on Sunday night in my men's league game.
You know, he scouts everywhere. You never know. He's always looking for that hidden talent, you know.
He can be a grinder. I scored a couple goals last Sunday, so.
We don't need goal scorers, you know, with what you bring to the table. I assume your skating is not going to make it there, so we might need you on the fourth line.
All right. I'm a grinder, so.
And there you go.
That's what we need. So, did I also understand that you spent some time working at Yankee Stadium?
Yeah, so the company I worked for when I started, one of the accounts I had was Yankee Stadium. So for me, I never thought I'd make a living in sports or entertainment. I'd graduate and get a job as a sales guy selling something. Who knows what it was going to be. My brother's 10 years older than I am. He's the oldest and the youngest and most successful guy I've ever met. You know, I was 9 years old. He was my idol. And yeah. I guess he still is, if you ask him. But you know, when he graduated college early, got a job selling toilet paper, you know, for American Can Company. So it was a little more than toilet paper. It was more fun to say he sells toilet paper.
For the story.
And, you know, I thought no one could be more successful than this. You know, we had a used company car, a Ford Granada. I mean, does it get better than that? And it was just what I assumed I would do. But one day when I was probably 16 or 17 years old, Yankee Stadium, I forget who the homestead was against, but you know, they were short-staffed. So normally what happens, they reach out to the other accounts in the area, you know, basically to bus kids in or bus people in. So when I was asked to go, no one else was saying yes. The guys that have already gone before. And I was like, yeah, I mean, not only will I go, I mean, I'll pay to go. I wouldn't, you don't have to pay me. And I was so excited because I knew what was going to happen when I got in there. You know, Lou Piniella was going to come to me and ask, you know, should Rigetti stay in the bullpen or should we make him a starter again? You know, I just assumed, you know, walking in the back door of the same place that, you know, Dave Winfield was walking in or Tom Don Mattingly, that was going to happen. And I just saw it that way, that I was now part of the Yankees. And the funny thing is, you know, I ended up working in the dish room as a dishwasher, and the room is, it's probably a 4x2 area.
Right.
Maybe the hottest place I've ever been in my entire life. Not that the staff wasn't overly nice, but they didn't go far out of their way to embrace a young 16-year-old whose only job was to scrape plates. They didn't even trust me to wash them. Uh-huh. And scrape plates and throw them in the prep rack. But I was just happy to be there, and the game was on the radio. So it wasn't completely inhumane. And when we left, I said something to security guys as I was leaving, you know, probably an hour after the game. He said something like, you know, have a good night. And what he was really doing was making sure I wasn't stealing anything. I was tempted to. And I said, yeah, it was just a great night. And here I am, I'm getting out in one of the worst neighborhoods in America.
Oh, yeah.
I really am not exactly sure how I'm supposed to, what train I'm supposed to, you know, try to figure out how to get on. Fortunately, there was someone there to help me. And I said, man, what a great night. I love working for the Yankees. And, you know, here's a 70-year-old guy, pretty angry at life. I said, you don't work for the Yankees. I said, yeah, dude, I literally, I'm walking out. And he said, nah, you're a dishwasher. And I'll never, I mean, it's, I don't know, 40 years later, it still sticks with me about what a jerk. Number one. Yeah. Number two, he was probably missing the greatest thing about his job. He worked for the Yankees and didn't recognize it. And from that moment on, I realized this is something I'm going to do. I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know when it's going to come about. That's why to this day, when I'm a real pronoun guy, if I hear someone say something about you, meaning the team, when they work with us, I just stop. So, well, that's us. You know, you're part of that. And it doesn't matter, you know, if you're here for your first shift ever as a ticket taker, working housekeeping staff or food and beverage staff, you're an intern or work at the front desk, if everyone does their job, and it sounds corny, but it's true, we will achieve our goals. And we really are only as good as, you know, the weakest person. And I get that people roll their eyes probably when I say that a little bit, but we want everyone to feel as if they work for the Preds, because guess what? They do work for the Preds, and you want people to carry that forward and be proud of it. But it really does go back to that one time at probably 12:30, quarter to one in the morning, where a guy was probably a little less than kind. Didn't know it. I don't know his name. I wish I did. I don't think he's with us anymore. If he is, it'd be a medical miracle. Because I think he was on his fourth pack of cigarettes that day when he was making me feel so badly. But I remember going home, and my parents waited up. They were worried about me. Yeah. They were always up when I got home, no matter what time it was or what condition I was in, which is a whole other story. Yeah. But my dad said, how was it? I said, well, I work for the Yankees. And most parents would say, no, you wash dishes. Yeah. He's like, yeah, you do. And that was the great thing about my parents. Oh, you know, they embraced things. They loved when you were excited. And if you weren't excited, they figured a way to make you a little bit more excited.
So we may have been at the same game.
Maybe.
I grew up in upstate New York, and I still remember fond memories as a kid driving from upstate New York, hopping on the train, and I had my glove in one hand and my hat on the other one, and I just knew Reggie Jackson was going to hit one out to me in right field. Yeah. I knew it was coming. Yeah. Which,
you know what's funny about that? That was probably a three-hour trip for you, right?
Uh-huh.
You didn't think about it. You were excited about it. And now when I hear people complain about, you know, why is this team not working in X city, and you know, people go through all the reasons, right? Traffic, this or that. I lived on Long Island. It was a three-hour drive to the Bronx. You just never knew what it was going to be, and your car was probably going to break down. But you didn't think about that, right?
No.
You never thought about it. I mean, I'm sure your dad saw those days differently than you did. Mm-hmm. Probably wasn't as much fun until he looked at you, and you were smiling and beaming with your glove, right?
It felt like a 30-minute ride.
Right.
I was just so excited. The energy was there. And
theory of relativity, right?
You got it. So, Sean, when was that first break for you into a major professional sports team? And I know, you know, very early on you were working for the Yankees and then moving into...
Well, I never really worked for the Yankees. I washed dishes for them. Now, again, the company I worked for, Volume Services, it's was one of those great companies. I was really fortunate. The GM of the account, called Mr. Butler, my sister ended up marrying his brother. So we're pretty close. At the time, he didn't know who I was, but he had 1,000 employees. We're one of really, really special guys. You know, all of us part-time employees, range in age, you know, from early teens to college and maybe a year out of college. But he knew everyone. And he knew what you were about, knew what drove you, you know, knew how to help you. He always saw his responsibility of being a little bit bigger than just being your boss and making sure you weren't, you know, drinking beer out back or doing something you shouldn't have been doing. It was really showing you that there's a bigger world out there. Just a wonderful, wonderful guy. And he's the one that kind of put you on a different path, you know, if you wanted it and if you were going to work for it. That was one thing. I mean, you had to work for it. And I was just fortunate. He exposed me to a few things that probably shouldn't have been as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old kid. And then, you know, our regional boss got to know him a little bit over some special events that I was allowed to take on. And while I was still in college, he came to me and said, look, we have a job for you when you're done. And yeah, I went home and told my parents, and they said, well, you're not going to cook hot dogs the rest of your life, are you? I said, well, I don't know. You know, we'll see. And I graduated in May of 90, and, you know, the economy wasn't that great back then. Job interviews were pretty hard to come by, and I always laugh. I really only had two job interviews in my entire life. The first one then, when I graduated, and I ended up leaving midway through the job interview because I realized I was about to get the job. And I started panicking, something I've never done before or since. But I just knew it didn't feel right, and this is not what I wanted to do. And I just got up and said, you know, thank you very much. And I walked out. And the guy was dumbfounded. And that was in 1990. My next job interview was about 20 years later for this job. And I ended up calling a guy named Steve Denny, who actually I have to call him today for something. He was our regional vice president. And I said, I'm in. And he said, all right, well, after the summer's over, you're going to work the summer, of course, and do some different things. I traveled a little bit with the company that summer for special events. And they built a management trainee program around me, which is pretty neat. I got to tap into it. And the idea was I'd go to four accounts for 3 months each. The first account I was going to was Palace of Auburn Hills, where the Pistons play. Brand new building. They just won their second championship. But I'd be there for 3 months. Then I'd go to Royals and Arrowhead or Truman Sports Complex, then the Metrodome. And then the last quarter, I just assumed probably Yankee Stadium, or I was hoping, I should say. And I got to Detroit on Devil's Night. If you don't know what Devil's Night is, you know, for a kind of shelter, I was a pretty worldly kid as far as street smarts, but still a little sheltered. You're driving all my worldly possessions in my pickup truck to my new home for 3 months on Devil's Night. I'm already homesick before, you know, I even crossed the Ambassador Bridge. And all I keep hearing is Devil's Night, Devil's Night, Devil's Night. I don't know what Devil's Night is. Yeah. You know what it is? Mm-hmm. The city of Detroit burns. Every vacant building gets set on fire. Wow. And I'm driving into it, and I'm just imagining this is where I'm going to live, right? Yeah. In this awful place. And I really, by the time I got to the Auburn Hills, we had a boxing night that night, which was always a pretty rough crowd.
Oh, yeah.
So I pull in, all my stuff's in my truck. It's like 4 o'clock. I just know that my truck's going to get set on fire or stolen. Now, we're in this beautiful suburbs of, you know, one of the wealthiest counties in the country, in Oakland County. But I go in, I meet my boss, Mr. Ambrose, shows me around. He said, you know, Ty, just observe things and, you know, just get out of here a little bit early so you can get settled. All right, all right. So we're talking throughout the night. And I said, well, how do you like your place? He got me a house with two other guys. So I haven't been there yet. It's about 8, 9 o'clock now. So you schmuck. Where's your stuff? I said, what's in my truck?
Uh-oh.
I said, well, when are you going to unload it? I said, well, I got home. He's like, you're not a very good neighborhood. You need to go right now. And then I was really scared.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I can't wait. I have 90 days. I'm going to be there. So 89 more. Next day, Halloween. Giants are playing. I guess it was Sunday I got there. It was Monday Night Football. And I forgot it was Halloween. Kids are banging on the door. It's awful. I literally sat on the couch and was near tears. But I have 88 more days to go. The third day, 87 more days to go, except the Pistons did something odd. They bought an amphitheater. And at the time, the amphitheater business was dead. I mean, it didn't exist anymore. And I'll never forget, I was in a meeting I shouldn't have been in. My boss couldn't be there, his boss couldn't be there, and Mr. Ambrose, the ultimate boss, couldn't be there. And Joe Ambrose is probably the most intimidating man I've ever been around in my life. I mean, he was a monster of a guy. He was smarter than anyone I ever met, worked harder than anyone I ever met. And he was a very giving of his time, but he wanted to impress it. But I remember what he said. You go to that meeting, and all we did there at the time was food and beverage. He said, you go to that meeting, and no matter what is said to you, you just say, oh my gosh, thank you. Ooh, that shouldn't have happened. Thank you. Oh, I'll look into that. Thank you. You don't say one more word than that. If you do, I'm going to kill you.
Uh-oh.
And when Joe said it, he didn't mean, like some people, I'm going to kill you. When he said it, you realized, if I say anything but those 6 words, he's going to kill you. So Tom Wilson, the CEO of the team at the time, he's with the Red Wings now, and another great mentor, told this big group, you know, all these vice presidents I thought were gods of the industry now.
Oh, yeah.
And you got, no, we're not. Mm-hmm. And wait, for who's going to volunteer to run this thing, oversee the renovations, they're going to put $15 million into the building. And I was just in awe, you know, looking around. No one said anything. So I went up to the CFO, who was our direct client, a guy named Ron Campbell, who became the president of the Lightning, mm-hmm. and I followed years later. And I said, look, Mr. Campbell, I'll do that. And I'll never forget, he said, oh, all right, that's great. Who are you? So I told him, he's like, oh, you're the guy that's here, you're the trainee, you're gonna be here 3 months. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, you gotta be here more than 3 months if you're gonna help oversee this. And in my mind, I oversaw the whole thing. In his, he's thinking, okay, we're gonna have this schmuck do this, this, and this to help. And you know, maybe we can get the food and beverage company involved a little bit more. But I remember I'd go back, he said, hey, have Joe call me. So I called Joe Ambrose at home, and he said, okay, you got to call Larry Hatch, president of our company, tell him what you just did, that you volunteered us to do a little bit more than we do right now. He said, I'm going to tell you this, by the time you hang up that phone, he's going to fire you. And by the time you hang up the phone, I'll be in the office. And you know what I'm going to do when I get there. So,
look out.
Made that phone call, got a hold of Mr. Hatch, you know, it took a little while. And he just started laughing. He said, well, we don't really do that, but you know, we are thinking about adding a division facility, our facility division of the company. So yeah, I think it's great. You'll be our point guy, you know, for us. I said, that's wonderful, that's great. I think I'll do as much as I can, and then whoever's coming to replace me in January, pass the torch to. He said, no, you're not leaving. I said, no,
I'm signing this up.
Yeah, 90 days or 87 more days. And then he said, how do you know it's 87 more days? I said, I hate it here. I mean, it's awful. And again, I was really homesick more than anything. And then he said, oh, you're gonna stay there. And well, I ended up being there 5 years, ended up replacing Joe about a year later because a lot of really good people, Steve Denny, Larry Hatch, yeah. Ron Campbell with the Pistons, Tom Wilson with the Pistons, just kept giving opportunity after opportunity. And kind of lived my whole career as if someone gives you an opportunity, just say yes.
Step up.
I mean, yeah. And that's my biggest advice to people is never ask, are you gonna get paid for it? Don't ask what the title is. You say yes and you prove yourself. All those things always take care of themselves. Hard thing for a lot of people to get and understand. But those guys just gave me more and more and more and more to do. And while I was doing that, I was growing within my own company, ended up, you know, taking over a lot of our facility planning, design, sales for new accounts, and just kept growing. Pistons were always my account, even after I left, went to St. Louis, worked with the Rams, finished their stadium, worked with them. From there, I commuted to DC to do the Redskins project. But around that time, I got an offer to go to an HDTV startup company. I didn't know what to do.
Right.
I've only worked for one company my whole life. So I called all those same guys. Hey, what do you think? And I remember Larry Hatch, president of the company, said, we got to do it. And this is, you know, this is a Microsoft thing at a time. Microsoft's pretty young, where this could be the best thing that ever happened to you financially, or you could lose every dollar you have. Regardless, it's going to be a pretty cool experience. Yeah. And you know, I talked to the Pistons, they were excited about it. They ended up investing in the company pretty heavily. And Ron Campbell, who's the CFO of the Pistons, you know, joined our board as one of the finance chairs. And it was awesome. I mean, it was really cool to be a part of the startup. I was the third employee, grew it to maybe 85, 100 employees. We were the first to broadcast HDTV in the country, first to do a live event, first to do a live sporting event, first to bring equipment to market. We were selling that chicken and the egg dilemma that it was so prevalent in the 90s. We were one of the first to go bankrupt as well. And truly, woke up one morning without a dollar in the bank. You know, I cashed out my 401k, invested the whole thing in the company, put every dollar we ever saved in it. My son was 2 years old at the time. Wow. My wife, we just found out, unfortunately, she was pregnant. So here we are, no job.
No money.
First time in my entire life. No money. No health insurance. I mean, nothing. And, you know, Pistons, who invested heavily in the company, I always thought would be my safety job. Well, they just lost all this money. They're not going to be my safety job. Figure I go back to the food and beverage company, I called, and that was there for me. But as you're waiting for that, you know, it was April Fool's Day, which is a bad day to go bankrupt because no one believes you. That night, I went online and found a job as a laborer in a construction company, and I started the next morning. Pistons called, say, you need to come up here. We need to talk to you. So I can't come for a few weeks. Maybe I can get up and back on a Saturday. They said, well, why? I said, well, I have a job. And said, you have a job already? And then they got a little mad. you knew this was coming. I said, no, I was as shocked as you, and things happened that should have happened. I said, where'd you get a job so fast? I said, I'm a laborer on a construction crew. I said, you're a what? I said, what are you getting paid? I said, well, it's $10 an hour off the books. I guess I shouldn't say that. I pay taxes on it.
Here comes the IRS.
Yeah, and I pay taxes on it after many, many an audit. And they started laughing. They said, well, we got something better for you. I said, okay, that's great, but I'll see you Saturday then.
Yeah.
And Friday night, I jumped in my car, drove to Michigan. And they were just laughing. But there was Tom Wilson, our CEO, and Ron, our CFO, and Mr. Davidson, our owner, who's just an incredible man himself. And I thought they wanted to talk about Unity Motion, you know, the TV company. And there were a couple, two, three questions, but it was almost like a blow off. Yeah. And I said, remember last year we tried to buy Lightning? I think we're going to get closer this year. Why don't you go down there and evaluate a few things? And when we're successful, you're going to join us and run the business. I just sat there dumbfounded, looking at all three of them. Yeah. I said, do you want to talk more about Unity Motion? And, you know, they both personally lost some money. Mr. Davidson lost a fair amount of money. And I said, no, it happens. Like, it happens. I said, well, yeah, you invest in a lot of companies. Most don't do well, and the ones that do really well. Yeah. But the best part about it is you discover who you want to be around, who you want to hire. And just a lot of good lessons, you know, from when I was 14 to this point, because they also talked about a few things I did over the years with them. And, you know, kind of the phrase I always live by is, it's always the right time to do the right thing. And I was just blown away. So I said yes. And I went home and drove back home. My wife, and I was going to split my time between Detroit and Tampa. Unfortunately, my wife's mother was fighting cancer in Detroit. So she had basically moved there, you know, with her son, which was nice circumstance as things go. Where I showed up in Tampa, where Ron Cable sent down, he wasn't there yet. I was the only piston guy, if you will, down there for the first few months. And he said, you know, we didn't even talk about your salary. I said, yeah, I know. I figured it'll be fair, and it was. You know, I mean, if you fought a little bit more, probably would have been a hair more, but you're not starting the right way. And he said, we didn't even talk about your title. And I said, you're right. I said, but the Redskins, I think, did something great back when Jack Kent Cook was alive still. No one had a title.
Oh, wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, and when people said, you know, so what do you do? They said, oh, I work for Mr. Cook. And you said, well, yeah, but, like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. And one of their guys finally pulled me aside. He said, well, first of all, stop asking that. Secondly, we all work for Mr. Cook. Smart people figure out what you do. Mm-hmm. The dumb people, we don't worry about. And I was like, this is great. You know, everything's equal. And in our, like in every industry, you have a lot of ego in the way. In ours, maybe even a little bit more.
Right.
And I thought that was just so great. So I pitched my boss on this. He was the CFO of the Pistons. He's going to be president down there. I said, Ron, none of us want titles. It'll be great. He said, well, how will people tell the difference between me and you or me and this guy? I said, well, you're the guy. Mm-hmm. He said, but people won't know it. I was like, no, but it won't be great. He said, all right, we'll try it. We'll try it for like a day. And we hired someone else to run a department. I don't know how far stretching this goes, so I won't mention his name. And in a presentation he was doing, he announced what his title was.
Uh-oh.
And then he said, we also have Sean Henry and Ron Campbell. And the feeling that we were both left was we were working for him. I was okay with the guys. Thought it was funny. Maybe not everyone in the room did. That day we all got titles.
It was done. Yeah. One day experiment. Yeah.
But it really was a remarkable thing to be offered that opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Being I was really never on that side. Now, through our other experiences, we did a lot of things with venues and that sort of thing. But it was really wonderful.
Yeah. And during that time, you got to hoist the cup. Your name is etched on the Stanley Cup. So.
Yeah, it was pretty
special. Tell me about
pretty
that
special.
Experience, Sean. I can't even imagine.
You know, it's one of those things where, you know, we bought the worst team in all sports in a building that was never finished and really an underdeveloped business. And again, I talked about it earlier, very separate businesses. You had hockey operations, you had the business of hockey, you had facility business, and they had facility operations. And they didn't meet at all. They didn't talk. You had separate Christmas parties, separate staff meetings. It was really bizarre. You know, where we're coming from, a place with the Pistons that, whether you're doing a circus or a concert or a game, it's all the same.
Yeah.
You know, you all drove forward to do something special, and you diagnose what you did wrong and figure out how to do it better the next day. So it was very dysfunctional. So right away, you know, we thought we were Midas touch. We'd come in and fix it all. And we didn't realize, you know, at times 70 employees or so, that we were the third owner in 3 years. We were the fourth management team in 3 years. And the employees were tired. They're all good people, but they were just tired of another guy coming in and saying, oh, you know, rah, rah, we're going to do this and this. And so it took a little while for people to really embrace that they were going to be in charge of what they did. We're going to connect with each other. We're going to do special things. And once you have a few little successes, people get a little bit more empowered. You start growing and growing and growing. We started investing in the building and the team. And it was just a special time. You know, we made the playoffs for the second time in franchise history. Mm-hmm. Went to the second round. We beat a much better Capitals team in the first round. And that's when everyone started believing, you know, in the walls, within the city, fan base.
When will do that, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, we have this good business plan that it really ignites on top of. The next year, we're the worst team in hockey in January, you know, a lot like the Blues.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're looking at what do we do if we don't change what we're doing in January on the ice. We're going to have to make some trades. And we had some great young players, Vinny LeCavalier, Marty St. Louis, Brad Richards, you know, Dan Boyle, Pavel Kamina, just go on and on and on. And a stud goalie in Nikolai Havlupulin, you know, an all-star. It was like, well, if we're not going to win with these guys, what do we do? Because it was not a fun time, you know, going into December and starting January. And then an odd thing happened. We just went on this incredible tear. The team started playing the way we knew we could. And I think we won 21 out of 24 games in the next. We ended up best record in the Eastern Conference. And fortunately, the Red Wings got eliminated in the first round. They were in the West back then, or maybe second round. So now we had home ice advantage if we're fortunate enough to go. And it was one of those magical years. You know, we lost the first game against the Islanders, ended up winning 4-1 in that series, swept Montreal 4-0, which is pretty neat. And then seven-game series against your big brother, the Bullies of Philadelphia, and they were like our Blackhawks. You know, when we played them, they took over our building. You know, they would take our players, they would abuse us, you know, leave with your friends. It was always disheartening when they came in because they were the standard of our conference at the time. And beating them was a lot like when we beat Chicago in the playoffs final. Okay. You're crossing a threshold. It's beating your brother in basketball that first time.
That sweep.
Right. It was just really changing the franchise. And it was part of the Stanley Cup was almost anticlimactic because of all the things we said we were going to do, all the things we built towards were there. And that was pretty neat. And we basically won before we played that first game. Then you still have to play those games. Having a seven-game series and a chance to win at home, it's special.
It's a pretty whole journey to get there.
It really is. I feel badly for teams that don't win at home. I mean, you take a win anywhere. You're playing, you know, wherever, Australia, and you'd be happy. But when you win at home, there's a different unifying feel, and it was great. But the best was, you know, summer we're planning on, you know, after the parade, of course. Okay, now what? We got to design the rings. We got to do all these things, and it was really fun. One of my better friends in the industry, a guy named Bill Wickett, who at the time oversaw our PR and marketing, and he and I worked in Detroit together too. We got called to Ron's office, and Tom Wilson was on the phone, and he said, we got to go over whose name's on the cup, how we spell it. And Bill and I had no expectation that our name would be on there. We didn't even think about it. And I think that's what made it so special. No one in the organization thought that way. It was just a great group of people. And, you know, first was Bill Davidson. You should be William Davidson or Bill Davidson, our owner. Should be Tom Wilson or Thomas S. Wilson. Mm-hmm. Should it be Ron Campbell or Ronald J. Campbell? And, you know, Bill and I are sitting there. Honestly, you're starting to get a little mad. Like, you know, it's like you guys have candy and we don't. Right. You know? So we get around to it, and Ron or Tom Wilson said, you know, Bill, going back to Mr. Davidson, should it be Bill or William? He said, well, everyone knows him as Bill, so I would think, you know, Bill. He said, I think it's going to be William. He said, well, what would you be? He said, well, and I'm thinking, what a jerk. Like, why is he doing this to him?
Teasing.
This is mean.
And nasty.
They said, well, I guess it would be Bill. I said, all right, you know, Sean, your name's pretty easy. It's just Sean. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah. He said, all right, so that's how it'll be. Bill Wickett and Sean Henry, unless you guys tell us otherwise. And we both were like, And it clicked, and, you know, they started laughing. And it was a pretty special day. All my work days, it was probably my best. Mm-hmm. Because whenever you get anything you don't expect, it's pretty special.
It's even better.
Yeah, you know, it's really neat. You know, you run out of the office, call your parents, you know, let your dad know, and, you know, you call your brothers, and you call you some of your oldest friends, and at first they don't believe you. So
especially how supportive your parents were.
Special. And our day with the cup that year, I look forward to our day with the cup someday here.
That's what I was going
to
ask, because that's the most well-traveled trophy
it was
across
awesome.
The country, around the world. So what was your day?
Well, the time we had three of our kids, our fourth wasn't born yet, and the three of them remind her of that all the time, that they won and she didn't. But it was fun. We did ours in September, Labor Day weekend. It was the year of the hurricane. Every other week there was a hurricane in Tampa that year. And it was incredible. We just put out feelers to everyone that I knew. Yeah. And growing up, you know, whether they were in St. Louis or Detroit or New York, I figured no one would come. I mean, it's pretty short notice. And we started the day. My wife and I used to work with a boys home for abused boys. There were about 20 kids living in a home. And we went there first with no thoughts of doing anything more than making them happy. And the guy that ran it, this couple that inspires you every day, you know, they're better people than I'll ever think about being. They said, would you mind if we invited some people over to take a picture? And I said, yeah, that's fine. Let's charge them, you know, $20, you know, just to raise some money, because we're always raising money.
Yeah.
Inside of 20 minutes, I bet there were 500 people there. I mean, it's staggering what that cup does. So my wife and I left there with the keeper of the cup, a guy named Mike Bolt, who's just wonderful. And we went to lunch. And he said, watch this. And he took the cup out of the case and put it on the front seat, put the seatbelt across it. And we could see his minivan. And he said, just watch. And I was like, this guy's crazy. What's he doing? And it's amazing. You'd see someone park, get out of the car, get right on their cell phone. And again, inside of minutes, there were 10 people around the car. By the time we were done with lunch, there were a traffic jam in this parking lot of this, you know, strip mall pizza place we're at. And that was fun. Then we went to my son's preschool and had some fun there with the teachers, took some pictures. Went to my son's elementary school, did the same thing. And then we brought it home. We had about an hour with it, alone, if you will. Just my immediate family, brothers and sisters were all there, my parents. A couple of my uncles were there. And then it just erupted. And we invited every employee. It was basically just an open house. And I've never seen that many people in a house. We had people signing just to see. And later on, we looked at it. We had about 600 people at our house. And you know, it wasn't a house that could hold 600 people. So they were on the lawn, the street. The garage was a bar. You know, we pool in the backyard. And it was just jammed. The best is at, I don't know, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, sitting in my living room. There was a couple sitting across from me. I'm sitting with my parents. I said, you know what? We haven't met. You know, so I introduced myself. And I said, well, we're embarrassed about this. We were looking at a house 2 doors down when we saw you carry the cup in the house. So we figured, let's circle back later and see what's going on. They said they came back at 8 o'clock, just came to the party. 6 hours later, they were still there. 2 days later, they bought the house and became really good friends with us, which is pretty funny. But that's what the cup does. I mean, it's a fun unification. But I was amazed. I had, you know, guys I went to kindergarten with that I don't really talk to that much. They showed up. You know, Mr. Butler, the guy I was talking about, his son showed up. And it was a really neat time, and it's a good celebration of what a lot of people did for you. So, yeah.
Just another chapter in the book.
Yeah, it'll be better
Stanley
here.
Stanley and the cup here.
Now we know what to expect.
So let me ask you this. Here you are at the pinnacle, and winning the Stanley Cup, having stories like that. So, Nashville. How did that come about, Jim?
Well, again, we're on top of the world as an organization.
Oh, yeah.
We won the cup on June 7th. I think on June 13th, we won the NBA championship as well.
Oh, wow.
So we won both within a week of each other. A few weeks later, we won the WNBA championship. A few weeks later, we won the AFL championship, Arena Football League. No owner in sports ever won 2 championships. Yeah. 2, let alone that. And, you know, within the same week. I mean, when I say no one's ever won 2, they've never won 2 ever. But to do it in, you know, a week is pretty incredible. So it was just a fun time. We were doing a lot of good things. We bought a couple of minor league baseball teams, a few amphitheaters. I mean, things were really good. I mean, Mr. Davidson just believed in letting people run their business. And if you needed to invest in something, invest in it. And, you know, fortunately, he was a little bit older. And he ended up passing away and went up selling everything. Sold the Lightning, sold the Pistons. The guys we sold it to probably won't go down in annals as the greatest owners in the world. They were underfunded. It just sometimes that happens. So I ended up working with the league to, the Pistons actually took the team back and then worked with the league to sell it to Mr. Vinnick, who owns it now. But when they bought the team, I was contractually forced to stay 6 months. And I did. I like giving 6 months notice.
Yeah.
And but then I had to stay on as a consultant for a period of time. Okay. And I really thought that's what I was going to do, because it was a pretty good gig. And the only negative thing about consulting is you're not part of anything.
Yeah.
And my whole life, I've always been part of a team, part of a group. And there's something about group success, group struggle, group failure. And it was fun. I mean, I made more money than I ever made in my life. I wore shorts every day. coached all my kids' teams, drove them to school, picked them up every day. I used to go to the building for the Lightning probably three times a week. Did that for about 18 months. And then when we took the team back, changed a little bit where I stepped into kind of interim CEO role. But I thought I'd still go back to those consulting days. Yeah. And I got a call about this job, and I was on vacation. And we go to the same place. We're going there next week. We've gone to the same place for 20 years with about 30 other families. And that's dwindled a little bit. Mm-hmm. But the rule is you don't leave the island. If you leave the island, you're just ridiculed. And there's no penalty. There's no financial thing. But you will make fun of me the rest of the trip. So we never left the island, you know. Probably at the time, 11, 12 years running. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I broke my foot, didn't leave the island. My son got stitches. I'm not proud of this. We didn't leave the island. He still has a scar from where stitched up. But you just didn't leave the island.
So I got a tradition.
I got this call from the headhunter, and he said, who I know really well, he said, you got to come up here, and the job interview's Thursday. This is on Tuesday. So I can't. He said, well, you can't. So I'm on the island. He said, well, you have to come. I said, I'm not coming. He said, you have to come. I said, I it's really not that important to me.
Before Survivor was there.
The island. And I hung up the phone with him. I told my wife, she said, what are you thinking? This is what you love. You miss being with a team. Not only that, you're the one that always talked about the Predators. And I did. It's such a special town. Oh, yeah. You know, we'd come up here every year with a sponsorship trip. And the building was never full when I was here. I never saw a sellout before I worked here. But even if it was 8, 9, 10, 12,000 people, it was loud, it was passionate. There was something that was really special with this. And this is right after the team almost left. And you come to a game after that, and it was like the fans owned the team. It was a really unique experience. Mm-hmm. She said, literally, you always talk about the Predators. What could be there if it was run a certain way? You got to go. So I called my next door neighbor.
Over. Like, honey, the island tradition.
Well, I'm still mad. I mean, we're going to go next week, and I promise you it will be the first and last thing someone says. Marilyn, you left. But my neighbor overnighted a suit to the Marriott for me. I flew up here, literally. The only thing you pack are bathing suits and shirt. I mean, there's nothing else. And I flew up here in bathing suit, flip-flops, and T-shirt. Their driver for me, which was very nice. Put the suit on reluctantly, getting sand off my feet. But he forgot shoes. So I have a choice. You go in flip-flops or you go buy shoes. I went and bought shoes, and it was the most bizarre interview I've ever been a part of. And then again, I never had an interview before. Yeah. So this is really my first time I'm going to sit through the whole interview. And it was with Tom Seeger and his son Chris. It was at Healthways. And every time Tom would ask him a question, Chris would say, you can't ask him that. Because Tom really wanted to know who you were. You know, what you're about, similar to what you were asking in the beginning. And then he talked about his own views of what the ownership group was like and what their goal was and how they were going to run the team. And there were so many similarities to the way Mr. Davidson ran the Pistons and the success we had because of it that you realize, oh my gosh, this is what I want. And I want it so badly. And that happened probably 10 minutes into the conversation that lasted 2 hours. And I got up thinking, I can't wait to come here. So I left, and I just assumed I'd start 2 or 3 days later, and this was in June, and so I called the headhunter, the airport, had to go. I said, I was great. I can't wait to be here. He said, well, you don't have the job. I said, well, you don't have the job. He said, well, they're interviewing a lot of people. So why? It was beyond me. I was so arrogant.
Just messed still am.
And I just didn't understand it because we really hit it off. I said, I promise you, when you talk to them, there are no more job interviews. This is it. And they did a wonderful job, screening maybe not a wonderful job screening because I still got through. But they ended up coming up here 3 times. Oh, and the third time, I'm like, what could you possibly ask me? I haven't asked me yet. The latter 2 times was with the entire ownership group, which made you want it more because it's such a good group of guys, and why they bought the team. It's for all the right reasons. All day one season ticket holders, all passionate about Nashville and the team. And when I was finally offered the job, I think before the sentence was or question was asked, I said yes. Same thing. Didn't even know what I was going to get paid. Didn't know anything because it's the right thing. And when you know something's right, you jump at it. And I'll tell you, it's been the best 9 years of our lives. It's absolutely been incredible for all of us. For my 2 sons, my 2 daughters, my wife. As you know, Nashville comes home the day you get here if you embrace it.
We arrived here about the same time. We moved here in 2010.
Yeah, September 10th.
We're not leaving.
Yeah, and that's what, almost immediately I told people, and all your friends are the same way, when are you coming back? It doesn't matter. If I talk to my friends in Michigan, when are you coming back to Michigan, St. Louis, there, New York, and obviously in Tampa, we were there a long time. But this is home. And, you know, since we've moved here, I've had three nephews move here, two cousins, my godmother. People come and visit, and you don't want to leave because it's special. And, you know, for me, I have the kind of extra blessing of being in such a great work experience, too. It's not just a great place to live. The work environment that, you know, we have, it's really special.
Well, one question about being special, because, you know, I've shared that my son plays hockey. We've traveled all across the country, and we've been able to see games in Detroit,
right,
in Chicago, in Las Vegas, Pittsburgh, all across the country. And every venue says, you know what, we want to be the best venue.
Right.
But all you guys here in Bridgestone have delivered on that. So what's been the key to making that happen? Because it's been remarkable for me, Sean, just to see it's night and day difference. I mean, the experience, the environment, everything you and your team have delivered here versus the other venues we've been in.
And they're all great venues.
Okay. Yeah, you mentioned, I mean, it's not a bad experience, but right, it's just, you know, good, better, best.
I believe most hockey experiences are great anyway, because it's just such a great sport. And, you know, the game itself will make it a great night. And then some people take that up a level or two, and I wish I could take credit for it, but that was here long before I got here. The whole spirit of Nashville is different. You know, what we did with the All-Star Game outside, and the NFL Draft, and obviously the Stanley Cup celebration. This city has changed the way All-Star Games are put out for our league. The city has changed how Stanley Cup games are celebrated before and after the games, and then most recently, same thing with the NFL Draft. So we get to tap into that. I think there's a few other layers that come with it. Again, I'm pretty fortunate. I worked with the Pistons for a lot of years, and they had a very simple philosophy, driveway to driveway. You know, the moment you get in the car to come to a game, we want to take over with a pregame show on the radio, and then when you hit the curb, that's when your experience starts, not when the game starts. You can't control what happens on the court or the ice or the stage, but you can control how people are greeted, how clean the building is, and most importantly, when something's wrong, and there are hundreds of things wrong every night, how do you respond? And I think that's where we do a pretty good job. Probably the most humbling thing for me is probably 60 teams have now been through our doors for meetings to say, how?
Wow.
How do you guys do what you do? Mm-hmm. And I like that, because we end up learning more from them than they're learning from us. And you just have a big conversation. The one thing that bothers me when teams say why, how's one thing. Why means, well, I got to go. I won't stay in those meetings. I really won't. So I'm like, I'll let other people out of the meeting. Because if you're asking why to treat your clients well, or your fans well, or your employees, or your players, or your performers, you probably could have solved that before you got here.
That's where it starts.
Right. And I always will answer it one way. Well, smart for your business. And you're like, people are writing it down. And so on the other is, it's more fun. And lastly, is there another way to do it? I really am perplexed to the point where I'll get a call from an owner or two from some of those teams I've been through, and they'll say, you know, our guys said you were pretty dismissive. I said, oh, I was. Because they asked the question, why do things right? And I said, I don't have time for that. And then we end up with a pretty good conversation on that level. But it is flattering when the SEC brings their entire business unit in here. When UT and us will connect, and it becomes collaboration. You know, I know some of the guys will come over here at first thinking, oh, we have to learn from, and pretty fast that's reverse, where we really are picking each other's brains, and now we have this network of, you know, hundreds of people that we get to call and say, hey, how'd you do that? You know, how'd you create this? Probably the best relationship we have in our league is with Winnipeg Jets, of all teams. You know, we won.
Not have thought that, given the rivalry.
No, most won't, but I always say we don't compete with any other team on ideas or business. On the ice, of course. How we recruit, of course. You know, how we, you know, treat our players, you know, that's all ours. But when it comes to how does our mascot rappel from the sky, or why, or what giveaways we do, or our pricing strategies, the better we all do, the better we all do. And again, the more we talk, the more we learn. But Winnipeg spent a long time here during our Stanley Cup run, and then came back in September and really wanted to work with the city to understand why the city cared so much about creating a special environment. Ironically, the next year, you know, we played them in the playoffs, and they created the same thing that we had. And it was really fun. So as much as we want to hate them, and we do, you know, once the pucks drop, they're a very similar mindset to us, similar size market. And when we played them those seven games on every off day, I had lunch with my counterpart. And we really talked about things. So, again, it's humbling, though, when people come to you and say, what are you doing? How are you doing it? And, again, you end up collaborating.
Prescribe to that continuous improvement mindset. I think every discussion is like, okay, here's a little bit I just learned. You just keep.
Yeah, that's the fun part. You know, for us, when I first got here, I wanted to go around a room with directors meeting and say, you know what? I'm just curious, you know, what was your biggest mistake this week? And, you know, first guy I asked was probably the wrong guy because he didn't have a lot of self confidence. He said, I have no mistakes. I said, okay. Uh-oh. Next guy, and then finally got to a third guy who just said, look, we do it as better. We do it better than anyone. We can't improve on what we do. So that's too bad because we've never gotten out of the first round. The team almost relocated 2 years ago. We're averaging 13,000 people a game. We're the 40th busiest building in the country. No one walks in here and says, wow, what a great building. So let's today figure out how to do better than we did without fault. And most importantly, let's all share the mistakes we had. And the key with the mistake is a lot of companies will beat up on you. Dean, what'd you do wrong? Yeah. Why'd you do that? What we have a culture of is, you know, what happened? Wasn't as successful as it should have been. And immediately is, all right, what could I have done? Yeah. And once you have that trust that's there, people will try a little bit more. And I mean, the amount of mistakes we make are limitless by the day. What's neat is how we step forward for them.
Is that part of the culture before you came, or is that something you started to instill?
I think it's something that we brought a little bit more to the table. And again, you know, the business side of what we were doing here wasn't here before Tom Seeger became chairman. It really was, you know, let's just survive and, you know, don't make mistakes, keep your head down, don't be innovative. And again, you had no connection department to department. Here you have the best GM in sports, the best hockey operations in sports, that if you just funneled, you know, a few more dollars to, it could do incredible things. And we're seeing it. And, you know, we haven't won the cup yet. But, you know, for the past 5 years, we're sitting right in the hunt.
There.
And you probably won't see many more, you know, Oiler, Islander, Canadian dynasties, you know, four or five in a row. But you can see the Penguins, the Blackhawks, the Kings, where win two or three in five, six, eight, 9 years, that's where we want to be. You know, put ourselves in that situation every year, they have a chance to do it. You know, Red Wings make playoffs 25 straight years. They win five cups in that period. That's where you want to be.
To your point, it's right there.
It is, and you look at, you know, this year's playoffs probably bring it to life better than anything. All number four number one seeds lost in the first round. And someone said, well, how often does that happen? I said, nebuary. No one ever thought it could happen. It's never happened in any sport because it really shouldn't happen, but it also shows how close.
It's one of the things I love about the NHL and hockey is the parity.
Yeah.
I mean, between one and eight.
Oh.
I mean, there's.
Well, really, probably. You know, through 12, right? It really is incredible. You look at the Blues, you know, the worst team in hockey in January. You know, they're going to make, you know, a goalie change. They want to bring up their top AHL goalie, but he's sick. So they bring up Bennington, who's probably going to play a couple of games, and my gosh, he just blows it up. He's just something to watch. He's just fun. It's like watching Marty Brodeur drop on the scene as a rookie. It was incredible. But again, you know, here they were, you know, the worst team in the league. And now they're Stanley Cup champions. They need to be in St. Louis right now.
Okay. So one other question, Sean. I had something that's near and dear to me, being a veteran. I mean, you guys, as an organization, as a facility, have just embraced. You've hosted events. So tell me where that mindset comes from.
Well, I think it's pretty simple. You know, those that are not veterans, and as you know, I'm not. You always look at veterans, and we always say, you know, thank you. You know, thank you for your service. And I know for myself, whenever you say that, almost feel guilty or hollow when saying it. And, you know, a lot of, you know, veterans and, you know, leaders we've had a chance to work with really talk about how important that is when people do say it, how much it's appreciated, especially with the generation before you where it wasn't always felt or said that way. So if we have an opportunity to use our logo and the passion our fans have for it to bring attention to an individual or a group of people or a way to celebrate people, we should do it. We're missing the boat if we don't. And we do it in an array of ways to raise money for a lot of different charities, but it's also fun in the middle of the game just to stop. And it's focused on one individual to celebrate all that have served. And as you know, in our games, it's probably the most moving thing that happens. And without exception, the person being honored is always so shy with the camera. right? And you see the emotion well up in him or her or the spouse or the children, as it should be. But every, without exception, I've been part of maybe, I don't know, 600 of them. There's always a very humble, almost embarrassed fashion. But for our fans, it draws attention that we all should do a little bit more. So we like doing that. And then if we have an opportunity, whenever someone calls and says, hey, we'd like to do this, you know, new event, would you do it? The answer is yes. We like saying yes to ideas.
Always.
Yeah, and it's easy. And my nephew or my niece just moved here. Her husband's a captain in the Army, West Point grad. They just moved here last week. So they're at our house, they have a brand new baby, one's on the way. And we honored one of his friends, you know, a few years ago. And the same thing, so why do you do it? And I thought, well, why do you do it? So I said, well, what we're doing is nothing in comparative to what you did, what you chose to do, and the sacrifices are made. So it's really a small thing that we do.
But Sean, I've been to 600, but probably 50 since we've been here, and I still cry every single time. I mean, incredible, the experience, and going back to visiting other arenas. I mean, every venue does it, but it doesn't have the same heartfelt emotional feel.
Big, and I'll tell you, everyone always beats up on this one player, a former player of ours, and we always sit down with our players and say, well, what would you like to see? What should we do bigger? What should we do differently? And Ryan Suter, it was his idea to say, we should do it a little bit more focused on the military hero of the night. And you know, it'd be really neat is if we got pictures of him or her in everyday life, in, you know, full gear and country, wherever it may be. And those are the most emotional points. And I don't know if it's when maybe the guy's hamming for the camera with his friends or when he's holding his daughter, right, at home. But it is cool. So it's fun that our players touch what we do as well. And obviously Nick Bonino carried that torch forward. And it's his program. And I don't know if you remember, we had that World War II veteran this past year. And, you know, I think those are always a little bit more special just because they're fewer and fewer of them every year. And it was really neat to be with him after the game. And Nick was talking to him about his own grandfather's service. And was talking about mine. And it's a really powerful connection when you see the players really moved by life.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So, getting my son, my 15-year-old son.
There's the dynamite we talked about. I hope.
It's okay. Here we go. It's coming down. But my son asked to pass on a thank you because the focus on acute community involvement, he was at the Elite Edge Hockey Camp at the Fort Ice Center, and he was fortunate to be in the championship game, and he ended up being fortunate to win the game and then score the winning goal in overtime. But guess who was there to see it? Was Roman Josi. He's like, Dad, Roman Josi.
That's pretty cool.
Watch me score.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
But it's funny with Roman, he was getting married this summer. They're getting married here. But he's been in town. And you know, he and his wife have been at everything. They've been at a handful of concerts or at Fort Ice Center every day. I mean, he's just out there skating, having fun. But they're at the CMTs. And I always say it's always fun for us, for fans, to see the players in everyday life, you know, doing the things that we do, that we love to do. And that's why I think it was special when we brought all the Titans players over to our games. As a fan, you want to know that the guys you like watching like the same things you do. So that's pretty special for your son. But I'll tell you what, if you ask Roman Josi, he could tell you exactly about the goal too. And he probably thinks he's lucky to have been there. So.
And after you calling your parents after the game, he called me, Dad, you can't believe we watched it.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's great.
Fun. So, one last question I always ask everybody because
this is a hard one.
This is a softball because it's open-ended. But I always tell everybody we're a new brand, we're a new business, we're on a 2-year journey, Authentically American. So I'm always curious perspective. So, Sean, when you hear Authentically American, what does it mean to you? Because you're a great American. What does it mean to you to be authentically American?
Well, I think the key of your brand and your product is the first word in it. And it goes back to everything we talk about. I worked with a guy once. I didn't like working with him. He literally was trying to train me. He said, if you can fake sincerity, you got it. And I thought, all right. I couldn't wait to get out of the room. But, you know, you can't fake authenticity. Mm-hmm. You can't fake your love for the country. You can't fake why you're doing this quality product. I wear the socks. I meant to wear them today, and I failed. So I apologize. You never gave me gold ones, though. So
we're working.
I never bought gold ones, but to me, you know, authentically American means just that. You know, you put other things ahead of yourself, and that can mean a lot of different things and for different reasons. But first and foremost, you know, it's America before party, America before profit, America before a lot of things, and sometimes you need to check yourself on it. And I think right now, the discourse that we have right now is just the opposite in all things. I don't even mean political, it's just on, I don't care, red or blue, whatever you are, both sides would say, well, that other side doesn't care about America. And I think there's a legitimacy to that.
I think it's so unfortunate that we've lost the sense of civility.
Right.
And we may disagree, but we treat each other with dignity and respect, and unfortunately we've lost that.
Yeah, I mean, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, you would have thought hated each other every single day, but at the end of every day, those two spoke. Yeah. And they couldn't have been more opposed politically on certain things, but they also realized 80% of what they had to take on, they did agree on. I mean, because it meant security, safety, growth in the economy. How you got there might have been slightly different, but it is a shame today that we fight about everything.
Very true. I'm trying to say we're an American ideal, doesn't matter which political party.
Yeah, because it's about the country.
You got it.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, you had mentioned the socks.
I wore socks today for you. Yeah. Normally I don't in the summer.
Yeah.
I'm kind of proud of myself there.
Because socks have been a popular guest gift. And
yes.
I thought, well, I can't give Sean the same pair of gifts, and I was wrestling with what to give you. But I know you're an M&M's guy, and I thought this was just a fun thing. Now, we can't, because I used to work for M&M Mars.
Is that right? I don't know.
So I had a great experience there, and it's amazing getting back to technology. So, you know, these are not the peanut ones. I know you prefer.
That's very cool.
Yeah, but those have our logo, so authentically American branded M&M's. So we're working on a partnership with them.
Is that right?
Yep. So
this is awesome.
Yep, so if you take one out, you'll see our, not only the traditional M&M's logo, but they're red, white, and blue, and our logos are on there.
And a good day for it.
It's
Flag Day.
Flag Day.
Yeah.
Well, Sean,
that's very cool.
Thank you. I know you're busy and lots going on, but I appreciate you taking the time, and it was fun to hear so
appreciate
much of your story.
You.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Authentically American Podcast. You can follow Authentically American on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all our episodes at authenticallyamerican.us/podcast. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.